Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to Bible class back in the hall, and there's another group out the back. Welcome to you as well, and a special welcome to all those listening online. I feel like in this era where, you know, the sea and the waves are roaring, we're sort of following the parable of Israel, where we're sort of coming back as small groups, and hopefully there'll be a flood soon. So it's really nice to have our brother Andrew Cridland and his family. He's like good on the Bible class committee for picking his theme of Zephaniah, the great day of Yahweh is near, because how relevant's that? So we're going to consider the first chapter of Zephaniah tonight. With that as an introduction, I'll invite your attention to our brother Andrew.
Thanks, Brother Ben, and good evening, everyone. Well, it's great to be here, especially as we start to see some of those restrictions being lifted and we can actually meet here in person to have fellowship. And I think that we can all give thanks to God that he gives us the opportunity to be able to meet together as we prepare for the coming of his Son. Well, welcome to the first of three nights on the prophet of Zephaniah. And what we're going to find in the course of these three nights is a very interesting and a very dynamic prophecy given in the days of King Josiah and contemporary with the prophet Jeremiah. And it's a message that begins in chapter 1 with the prophecy of the destruction of Jerusalem and the captivity of the nation of Judah. Chapter 2 begins with a stern and an urgent warning to all those who would listen, and it ends with God's judgments upon the Gentile nations surrounding Judah. And chapter 3 concludes the prophecy with a vindication of Yahweh's just judgments, the hope of the nation restored, and a time beyond even our day when the kingdom would be established on the earth and all nations would turn to God with praise and worship. And that's what makes this prophecy so relevant to us today. And we're going to see this time and time again, lessons for us, the key to our salvation and the wonderful vision of the future. This is a powerful prophecy. And even though it's only three chapters long, it's jam-packed full of relevant prophecy. Many pieces we will see have already been fulfilled and some that are still to come. And that's why we've used the overall theme of the great day of Yahweh is near. Because he is near, brethren and sisters and young people. Just like the day of Yahweh was near for the nation of Judah in the days of Zephaniah. Just let that sink in for a moment. The great day of Yahweh is near. And our Father in heaven reminds us of that time and time again, that his Son is soon going to be upon this earth. And chapter 1 is full of warnings about the great day of Yahweh. And as we're going to see, these warnings were largely ignored by the nation of Judah and the people of the day. Well, does that sound familiar? Well, it sounds exactly like our day today. We have all these warnings in the Bible full of information about the impending judgment, that Yahweh's day of judgment of this world is coming, and the Apostle Peter tells us that it begins with the household of God. And what we will see in the prophecy is that we need to be careful to not become complacent, just as the people were in the days of Zephaniah. So what do we know about Zephaniah? Well, we actually know a lot about Zephaniah. And there's probably three main things that we know about Zephaniah. We know his name, we know his genealogy, and we know the time period in which he prophesied. So let's just have a look at each of those, starting with the name of Zephaniah. Actually, Zephaniah actually doesn't start with a Z in the Hebrew. It starts with a TS, so it's Zephaniah. And Zephaniah's name means Yahweh has hidden, which is completely appropriate once you start to get into the detail of this prophecy. You see, the theme of being hidden runs throughout the prophecy of Zephaniah. So we might naturally ask the question, well, what has Yahweh hidden? Well, we discover that there's actually three aspects of this theme of Yahweh has hidden, and they all combine to present us with the spiritual state we find at the time of Zephaniah, and indeed we find it in our day today. And the first of these three aspects is concerning God himself. It's clear from Zephaniah and other contemporary prophets that God had hidden his face from the people. You know, it was Moses who really set the scene for us in Deuteronomy chapter 32. We won't turn to it for the sake of time, but in Deuteronomy chapter 32, we have the prophetic song of Moses. He sings of the faithfulness of God and the faithlessness of Israel. He sings of the chastisement that they need and the affliction by God. And he sings of God's compassion on the low state of the humble people. And in verse 15, Moses says, "But Yeshuan waxed fat and kicked. Thou art waxen fat, thou art grown thick, thou art covered with fatness. Then he forsook God, which made him and lightly esteemed the rock of his salvation." And so this verse is speaking about Israel. And Moses knew that he knew what would become of the people once he had passed off the scene. He knew that they would wax fat and that they would forsake God. And the end result that Moses prophesies in verse 20 is, he says, "And he said, I will hide my face from them, for they are a froward generation, children in whom is no faith." And the word hide there from Deuteronomy is the Hebrew word sathar. I will hide my face from them. And we'll see that same word in Zephaniah. And so all the way back to the days of Moses, we have this prophetic song about the day when Yahweh would hide his face from the people. And many years later, that's pretty much what we find is happening around the time period of Zephaniah and Isaiah and Ezekiel. And for example, here we have Ezekiel 39, verse 23. "The heathen shall know that the house of Israel went into captivity for their iniquity, because they trespassed against me, therefore hid I my face from them." So Yahweh had hidden his face from them. The second aspect to the theme of being hidden relates to the attitude of the people at the time. You see, the people were generally doing what they pleased. They thought that they could hide from God, or maybe they just didn't care. Jeremiah records in chapter 16, verse 17, "For mine eyes are upon all their ways, they are not hid from my face, neither is their iniquity hid from mine eyes." And so you can start to understand the situation that existed at the time. They thought they could hide their wickedness from God. However, God had hidden his face from them. And the third aspect of that theme of being hidden is found in Zephaniah 2 in verse 3. We're going to consider that in more detail in our next class, but you can see there that at the end of that verse, talking about those who seek Yahweh, he says, "It may be ye shall be hid in the day of Yahweh's anger." So here's that Hebrew word, sathar, "that ye may be hid." Yes, the people thought that their wickedness was hid from God. Yes, God had hidden his face from the people. But equally so, we find that those that seek God, those that are meek, are still very much in the mind of God. He would protect them, and he would hide them in the coming judgment. And so those three aspects that we've found in the book of Zephaniah, just from his name, a warning: Yahweh has hidden his face from the people. Another warning: you can't hide what you're doing from Yahweh. He sees and he knows everything. And as we'll see, he would search them out with candles. And the third aspect, an exhortation: Yahweh remembers those that are faithful and will hide them from the coming destruction. And what's absolutely amazing and truly undeniable is that each three of these aspects are in the days that we live. The face of God is hid from the world. The world thinks that their ways are hid from God, and maybe sometimes we can fall into that trap. But even so, each one of us has the opportunity to be amongst those that Yahweh will hide in the great day of judgment coming upon the earth. And so the second thing we know about Zephaniah is his genealogy. And when we come to Zephaniah 1 and verse 1, we read there that the word of Yahweh came unto Zephaniah, the son of Cushai, the son of Gedaliah, the son of Amariah, the son of Hizkiah. You know, it's very unusual to have this many generations mentioned when it comes to the lineage of a prophet. If you look through the Bible, if you have a look at Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Hosea, Joel, Jonah, they only mention one generation, the father of the prophet. Have a look at Amos, Obadiah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Haggai. It doesn't even tell you about their genealogy. Zechariah, he goes down two generations. But here we have Zephaniah going down four generations. So it's got to be an important point, I think. Well, consider the names and the meanings. Zephaniah, as we've seen, Yahweh has hidden. Cushai means black. Gedaliah means Yah is great. Amariah means Yah has spoken. And Hizkiah, which is a variation of Hezekiah, means Yah is strength. And when we put these names together with Zephaniah's, we get Yahweh is strength, he has spoken, he is great, but blackness has come upon the nation because he has hidden his face from them. It's suggested by some commentators that the Hizkiah mentioned here is actually a reference to King Hezekiah, and perhaps there's some relationship that we're not told about in the Bible. But whatever it is, Zephaniah is telling us that he has a generation which is stretching back over all those evil days during Manasseh and Ammon preceding Josiah. You know, I think we also find a similar situation in our day today, don't we? Today it's still true. Yahweh is strength. Yahweh has spoken. He is great. But the world around us is black. It's in darkness because they've rejected God and he has hidden his face from them. And so the third thing we know about Zephaniah is the time period in which he prophesied. We've seen already in chapter 1 and verse 1 that he prophesied in the time of Josiah. So that would be around 640 to 610 BC. As you can see from the slide, it's before the nation went into exile. So still very similar themes to what you would have considered when you were looking at Haggai, which was prophesied after the return. But here we have the nation in a time before they went into exile. And it's fair to say that Judah was in a bad way around this time. Josiah had become the king at the age of 8. The nation was steeped in idolatry. There was worldly practice. They were totally insensitive to the times of the truth because of that nearly 60 years of the evil reign under King Manasseh. And I don't think we can emphasize enough just how bad and how evil things were under the leadership of Manasseh. It was so bad in that time that Yahweh had determined the end of the nation. He knew there was no way that they could change. And Amon was no better than his father Manasseh. And born into this lineage, you have Josiah, a king who did that which was right in the sight of Yahweh. We all remember the story of Josiah, so there's no need to look at it in detail. Manasseh had attempted to destroy all of the Bibles, but in 2 Kings 22, one Bible was found in the rubble of the temple. And as Shaphan reads the book of the law to the king, Josiah starts becoming more and more concerned about the nation. The realization hits home that they'd been so wicked that in a state of despair, he rips his clothes and he weeps for the sins of his forefathers and for the sins of the entire nation. And Josiah sends that delegation to Huldah, the prophetess, to consult of God, and the response comes back in 2 Kings 22, verses 16 to 17. Thus saith Yahweh, behold, I will bring evil upon this place and upon the inhabitants thereof, even all the words of the book which the king of Judah hath read, because they have forsaken me. They've burned incense unto other gods, that they might provoke me to anger in all the works of their hands. Therefore my wrath shall never be kindled against this place. The nation was under an irrevocable divine sentence of judgment. Nothing could be done to change the coming judgment, at least not on a national level. It was absolutely hopeless for them. There was no way that the nation would be converted back to God. However, the mercy was still available to the individuals. And God says to Josiah through the prophetess in verse 20, behold, therefore, I will gather thee unto thy fathers, and thou shalt be gathered into the grave in peace, and thine eyes shall not see all the evil which I shall bring upon this place. So the individual could still respond and be saved. Josiah here is promised that he would not see the evil to come, that he would be sleeping with his fathers. And that's exactly what happened. Josiah died at the age of 39, and within 30 years, the nation was gone. The impending judgment was a foregone conclusion. However, this didn't stop Josiah instituting the greatest religious reformation of any of the kings of Israel. You know, Zephaniah and Jeremiah are a contemporary. And just to emphasize the point, things were really bad in Judah. You know, they were so bad that God says to Jeremiah in chapter 5 and verse 1, he says, run to and fro through the streets of Jerusalem. Look and take note. Search her squares to see if you can find a man, one, who does justice and seeks judgment, that I may pardon her. How awful is that? This is during the time of the Reformation. Find me just one faithful man in the streets, and I will forgive all of Jerusalem. You know, when the angel spoke to Abraham regarding the destruction of Sodom, it got down to 10 people. Find me 10 people and I won't destroy Sodom. Well, here God's saying, find me just one man in the streets. You see, God could see the people. He could see what was in their hearts. And he told Jeremiah in chapter 3 and verse 10 that even with this great religious reformation, the nation of Judah hadn't turned to God with her whole heart, but rather they'd done so deceptively. It was only pretend. It was a falsehood. They packed the ecclesial halls, and they claimed in Jeremiah 7 that we were the temple of Yahweh, and God calls them hypocrites. And so the voice of God comes to Zephaniah as Yahweh's judgments are decreed in chapter 1, verses 2 to 6. God says in verses 2 to 3, I will utterly consume all things from off the land, saith Yahweh. I will consume man and beast. I will consume the fowls of the air and the fishes of the sea and the stumbling blocks which the wicked. And I will cut off man from off the land, saith Yahweh. Verses 2 and 3 are an allusion back to Genesis chapter 6. Just listen to the words of Genesis 6 and verse 7, spoken by God because of the wickedness of man that was great upon the earth. And he was going to destroy them with a flood. And he says in Genesis 6 and verse 7, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of this earth, both man and beast and the creeping thing and the fowls of the air. Well, it's exactly the same language which is used here by Zephaniah. In other words, Yahweh is taking our minds and the minds of the people back to the very beginning. It's a reminder that the coming judgment is not without precedent. Remember Noah, God is saying in this prophet. Remember how the whole earth was filled with wickedness. I told them I would destroy man, beast, fowl and fish, and it happened just as I said. Man, beast, fowl and fish were destroyed in the flood. The flood was inevitable. There was no way that they could stop it, just like there was no way that they could stop the judgment upon the nation. In verse 3 of Zephaniah 1, also says that God would consume the stumbling blocks with the wicked and cut off man from off the land. And if you've got a wide margin Bible, you'll find the word stumbling blocks here is the Hebrew word which means idols. But what do we think about when we think about idols? Well, the one that usually comes to mind is the golden calf with the children of Israel in the days of Moses. But really, an idol is anything that can take our imaginations and our minds away from God. And again, in Genesis 6 and verse 5, it says that God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. This imagination had lost focus on God. And the people are described as being evil continually. I think you would describe the world like that today as well. The world today has put in place every possible stumbling block and idol that would take their focus and their minds and their imaginations away from the pure worship of God. The Apostle John warns us in 1 John 5 and verse 21, little children, keep yourselves from idols. And so, having opened the prophecy by drawing our minds back to the destruction that came with the flood, Zephaniah now starts to pinpoint exactly who these judgments were aimed at and the reason why they were coming. God turns his attention to Judah and Jerusalem. And the first issues that we have him dealing with in verse 4, I will also stretch out mine hand upon Judah and upon all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and I will cut off the remnant of Baal from this place, and the name of the Kemarims with the priests. So God was going to cut off the remnant of Baal. And the word remnant there is the word for name. So Yahweh would remove the name of Baal. Well, Baal was a ancient Canaanite and Mesopotamian deity that was associated with being the giver of life. And these people were worshipping this idol when they should have been looking to God, the true giver of life. And God was going to cut off the name of Baal so it would be remembered no more. He would also cut off the name of the Kemarims. Well, the word Kemarims means the black-robed priests. It's the same word used in 2 Kings 23 as part of the reformations when Josiah put in place. Josiah, it's recorded there, put down the idolatrous priests whom the kings of Judah had ordained to burn incense in the high places of the city of Judah. That word, idolatrous priests, is the Hebrew word Kemarim. Strong says that it's the Hebrew word meaning the ascetic. It's as if they're shrunk from self. They're self-macerated. It gives the sense of someone who harms themselves. It reminds me of the worshippers of Baal on the Mount of Carmel, where they were singing and dancing and carrying on for hours and hours, cutting themselves, doing all sorts of things. And their focus and their passion is so much upon these things that the word there talks about how they just shrivel up like someone who hasn't eaten. They're so full of passion and desire of these idolatrous worshipping that they just wither away, they wither up. Yahweh said he would remove those. He also says at the end there, with the priests. Well, that word priest there is a different Hebrew word to Kemarims. It's the Hebrew word Kohen. And it means a priest or a principal officer or a chief ruler. And the word in the Bible is used in a variety of different ways, but it also includes the Levitical and the Aaronic priests. These were supposedly the Christadelphian leaders of the day. And it's quite likely that they had aligned themselves to the Kemarims. What a terrible thing to imagine. And it's a warning for us today to be mindful and to understand the consequences of aligning ourselves with those that teach false religion. And this was in the house of God. Those would be removed. In verse 5, Yahweh continues, those that worship the host of heaven upon the housetops. See, the rooftop in those days was a place that you would go to pray to God. But these people weren't up there praying to God. They had turned to the stars and astrology to guide them. And so you've got this situation where during the day, you've got these people down in the temple and they're shouting and they're singing, the temple of Yahweh are we, the temple of Yahweh are we. But at nighttime, they're up on their rooftops and they're practicing astrology to guide them. Yahweh would also remove those that swear by Yahweh and swear by Malcolm or Molech, as it should be rendered. Molech was the god of the Ammonites and Phoenicians. This was the god where we have the description of some Israelites who were sacrificing their infants in the Valley of Hinnom. So these are the people with a divided allegiance. Out of one side of their mouth is coming all the praise to God. They're giving him lip service. Perhaps they're at the meetings. And on the surface, they appear to be a good Christadelphian. But out of the other side of their mouth, they're praising and they're serving Molech. Remember the words of our Lord Jesus Christ in Matthew 6 and verse 24. No man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. Ye cannot serve God and mammon. It's something we need to be mindful of today. We can't have one foot in the ecclesia and the other foot in the world. He would also remove those that had turned their backs on God. The word turn back is the Hebrew word to flinch, to go back, to retreat. It's the word rendered backslider in Proverbs 14 and verse 14. This person used to serve Yahweh, but not anymore. They had gone back into the world. It reminds me very much of the parable of the sower, which is very applicable to us today. You've got the seed that fell on the stony ground. Trials and tribulations come up, and they're offended and they turn their back on God. The seed that fell on the thorny ground, the cares of the and the riches of the world choke them, and they become unfaithful. And we've also got those that had not inquired of Yahweh, the lazy believer. The word sought in verse 6, those that have not sought Yahweh, the word sought there is the Hebrew word bekash, and it means to search out or to strive after. And the word inquired is derash, which means to seek diligently. This is the group of people who believed in God at one point, but they had slipped into that Laodicean spirit. They're sitting at home, there's a Bible on the shelf, but it's collecting dust and it's never being used because they didn't seek out Yahweh diligently. But we know the words from Hebrews 11 and verse 6, but without faith it is impossible to please him, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. Notice the word in that reference in Hebrews, diligently seek him. If you're going to come to God, it's not going to happen if you simply become a Christadelphian and your name is listed there as a member, but then after that you become complacent and inactive. We've got to be a person who diligently seeks God. And we do that by reading the Bible, praying to God, praising God, listening to the meetings, doing a little study, having our lives reflecting our belief. That's the sort of person who diligently seeks Yahweh. And so what we've just found in these few verses here in Zephaniah is the finger of God is pointing at different groups of people in judgment. You, the idolaters, I see what you're doing. You, the false priests that have a false religion, you can't hide from me. You, those priests that should be worshipping me, but instead you've aligned yourselves to the false priests, I've been watching you. You who worship the stars instead of me, I know what you've been thinking. You who worship God and mammon, I can see your allegiance is divided. You who've turned your back on me, I used to know you. You who call yourselves believers but don't seek me diligently, your apathetic worship hasn't gone unnoticed. It's been thousands of years, brethren and sisters and young people, since the prophecy of Zephaniah. And after all that time, we still have each one of these groups today. They can all be found. And God is pointing his finger at each one of these groups today and is saying that a time is going to come very soon when they'll all be gone. It's going to happen when the Lord Jesus Christ returns. And I think most importantly for us is to heed that warning of Zephaniah and not become complacent in our walk toward the kingdom. We need to continue to seek Yahweh diligently. And so in verses 7 to 13, Zephaniah gives us a fairly detailed description of the impending day of Yahweh's judgment upon the nation. And in verse 7, it opens up with, "Hold thy peace at the presence of Yahweh." Rotherham uses just one word for this phrase, "Hush! Hush, be quiet!" Like a parent would say to their child. Yahweh is saying this to the nation, "Be quiet and listen to what I'm about to tell you." And there's two things that God tells the nation in verse 7. He says that he's prepared a sacrifice and he's bid his guests. The word sacrifice is the Hebrew word zebak, and it means a slaughter. The nation was going to be the sacrifice. God was going to put them to death as a punishment for sin. Everyone except those hidden ones that we'll see in Zephaniah 2 and verse 3. And the ultimate goal of Yahweh wasn't to destroy the nation completely, but the sacrifice was a necessity. If God did not intervene in times of evil, sin would be triumphant. And things would just continue to get worse. Isaiah 26 and verse 9 says, "When thy judgments are on the earth, the inhabitants of the world will learn righteousness." And the same thing is needed today. And it's soon going to happen when our Lord Jesus Christ returns. And he's bid his guests. The word "bid" is also sanctified or prepared. And the word "guests" is invited or called out once. Here, Zephaniah is talking about the Babylonians who would act as his priests to slay the Judah sacrifice. Taking a little bit further, Jeremiah 27 verse 6 says, "Nebuchadnezzar was God's servant." In that reading there, Jeremiah 27 verse 6 says, "And now have I given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant." It's not the only time that God had sanctified other nations to do his work. Here it's Nebuchadnezzar. Well, in Isaiah 13 and verse 3, Yahweh calls the Medes. He's sanctified the Medes. They're called his sanctified ones, and their job was to do the same thing to the Babylonians. So Judah would be the sacrifice, and Nebuchadnezzar would be the sacrificial instrument used by God. And verses 8 and 9 show us that every single class of person would be sacrificed. Your status, your wealth, your position couldn't save you. And Zephaniah starts at the top, and he points in verse 8 to the nobles and the king's sons, those that are in a position of responsibility. Well, we know from the record that Josiah's sons did not live up to the example of their father. In fact, under their kingship, the nation continued to decline. It's quite significant, of course, that Josiah is not mentioned here, showing that his heart really was right with God, that the Reformation was not just a political stunt, that he really wanted to get his people back to God. Zephaniah points next in verse 8 to those that wore strange apparel. In the Hebrew, it's the word nokrai, and it means a foreign or a non-relative or adulterous or outlandish garments. And in the days of Moses, the people would wear a blue fringe around their garments to signify their heavenly calling. But here the people wanted to fit in with the nations around them. And it was probably really rare to see anyone with that fringe of blue. The general population had turned to strange apparel. Romans 12 and verse 2 puts it into context on our day. The apostle tells us, "And be not fashioned according to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, and ye may prove what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God." It's a warning for us to conform to God rather than the world. And Zephaniah also points his finger at the masters and the servants in verse 9. Here we have a mention of those that leap over the threshold, and those same people were filling their master's house with violence and deceit. And commentators really give us two possible versions of what this is talking about. The first one is that marginal reference there you've got of Samuel 5 and verse 5, 1 Samuel 5, verse 5. And in that reference, it's talking about when the worshippers of Dagon would leap over the threshold as they went in to worship the idol. And so perhaps the nation, again, is reflecting here of being steeped in idolatry. The other suggestion is that in these days, there was a lot of theft and plunder. It was rife in those days. And so the masters were sending the servants who would leap over the threshold of someone's home and would rob and plunder it with violence. And so God is saying to the servants, well, don't think you can turn around and say, well, it's not my fault, I'm just doing what my master's telling me to do. No, he's saying both the servant and the master were equally responsible for this evil practice of leaping over the threshold and taking the household's goods by force. And so really, Zephaniah is pointing his finger at every class of person, the nobles, the king's children, the people in general wearing strange apparel, the masters, the servants, and not one group of those people would be exempt from the sacrifice, except for those that are hidden in chapter 2 and verse 3. And think about it again in our day. The coming judgment on the earth is going to cover every cross-section of people. The nobles, the royals, the general population, the rich and the poor, everyone will feel the effects of the coming judgment. And it's only that small group of called out ones, the group that we are all a part of, who will be hidden and protected in the day of Yahweh. And what Zephaniah describes from verse 10 onwards is so graphic and so detailed that it wouldn't surprise me if he had actually witnessed this in vision. And what Zephaniah sees is he sees the army coming down from the north. They arrive at the fish gate, the northern part of the city, and they lay siege to the city. And so the fish gate would have been the first part of the city that would raise the alarm in the event of an attack. And as the army continues into the city, the alarm continues to make its way throughout the city. The city, which is intersected by that valley and split between the upper and the lower city. And so the second part, that lower city, begins to panic and howl in verse 10. And now you've got a city which is on high alert. The army is swarming into the city. There's screams of terror. The sound of battle is reverberating throughout the whole city and beyond the walls, even out to the hills. In verse 11, the army is making its way to the lower part of the city. The word Maktesh in verse 11 signifies a depression, and it's rendered by Rotherham as the lower city. It's probably the area of significant commercial trade. And you have the merchant people being cut down as the invading army takes the spoils. And look at what Yahweh says in verses 12 to 13. He's going to search Jerusalem with candles. He's going to search out and punish all those that are settled on their lees. It's the dregs of society. It's those who didn't really believe that God would do good or evil. They thought that he had just disappeared. They dismissed the prophecies. They thought that their evil could be hid from God. These people thought that they could be safe in the dark, that their ways would be concealed, that Yahweh doesn't even know what they're doing because he's not even watching. But Yahweh makes it clear in this prophecy of Zephaniah that you cannot hide from God, that he was going to search them out using a lamp. You can't hide in the dark. And if you get an opportunity during the week, have a look at Ezekiel 9. We don't have time to look at it in detail, but it does make for some graphic reading about these events. And you've got that vision in Ezekiel 9 as Yahweh describes to the prophet what would happen to the city in the day of judgment. Yahweh calls with a loud voice those that would action his judgments. Six men from the north come to do his biddings, and they're carrying their weapons of slaughter. One of those men is described as wearing linen, and he's got an inkhorn at his side. His job is to go and search throughout the whole city, perhaps with a lamp, looking for faithful brethren and sisters. Search out for those that were sighing and crying for all the abominations that were being committed. And that man with the linen, with the inkhorn, would search out the city, and he would come upon a faithful brother or sister, and he would mark their forehead with the inkhorn. And then he would go and search again, find another, mark the forehead with an inkhorn. These were the people that Yahweh would keep safe. And behind him comes the five others, the weapons of slaughter at the ready, probably with lamps in hand to search out the city. And their job is to go and smite, destroy, take no pity, spare neither old nor young, male or female. Start with the elders and keep going until the job was done. But they were explicitly warned by God, don't you dare touch those with the mark on the forehead because I am protecting them. And so it's no wonder then this final section in verse 14, we have the absolute urgency concerning the near approach and the terrible nature of the judgment. In verse 14, the great day of Yahweh is near. It's near. It hasteth greatly. Three times the day of being near is emphasized. And Zephaniah is trying to get this sense of urgency across to the people. It's near. It's near. It's speeding along. Just like the day of Yahweh is for us. And in verses 15 and 16, the days are described in detail. It's a day of wrath. It's Yahweh's wrath. It's a day of trouble and distress. It's the people's reaction to the outpouring of God's wrath. It's a day of wasteness and desolation. Similar language used in Genesis 1 and verse 2 to describe the earth which was without form and void. That political landscape would be decimated and broken up by the army. It's a day of darkness and gloominess. It's as Micah prophesied in chapter 3 and verse 6, the sun shall go down over the prophets and the day shall be dark over them. It's a day of thick clouds and thick darkness. It's a day of trumpet and alarm as the sound of the battle rage around the city. Amidst it, all the men, you've got the man dressed with linen, marking the foreheads. You've got the army coming down to destroy the people and bring death. And verse 17 and 18 is the end result. And it's described by Zephaniah in these closing verses as a people in distress. They're walking around like blind men in the day of Yahweh as it rages around them. Nothing, not their silver, not their gold, not their hidden places, not their own strength. None of that could save them in that day. Only those that Yahweh had hidden would be saved. Brethren and sisters, the Bible and history attest to the fact that these events took place. We only need to look at things like the chronicles that have been written of the day. Here's an example of one on the slide where Nebuchadnezzar chronicles these events and some of his conquests. Jeremiah 39 describes that great day of the Lord. He describes how Nebuchadnezzar besieged the city of Jerusalem in the ninth year and the tenth month of Zedekiah, that the city was broken up 18 months later, that Zedekiah tries to escape but is caught, his sons are executed, the nobles were slain, the king's eyes were put out, the king's house was burned, the people's houses were burned, the walls were destroyed, and the remnant were taken away, with only the very poor being left in the land. And so the day of Yahweh came as prophesied. The phrase day of the Lord is found about 30 times in the Bible, but the book of Zephaniah uses the phrase the most out of all the other books, 7 times in total. So for such a small book, it's got a heavy emphasis on that day of the Lord. But we know that there's another day of the Lord coming, and it's not too far away. It's a day that's mentioned in Acts 17, verses 30 to 31, where God has commanded all men everywhere to repent, because he hath appointed a day in the which he would judge the world in righteousness. And we have to have that same level of urgency that we have in Zephaniah 1 and verse 14. It's how the scriptures ends in Revelation 22 and verse 20. Behold, I come quickly. And the day of the Lord is explained in 2 Peter 3 and verse 2, in some of the verses in 2 Peter 3. And we'll just close and conclude just picking up one or two of the points in 2 Peter chapter 3 in closing. 2 Peter 3 and verse 10, the day would come as a thief in the night. Political powers would pass away, just like the great noise heard in the city of Jerusalem. It would all melt away and the works of the nations would be burned up. And in verse 11, the Apostle Peter asks us the question, well, if these days are going to come to pass, then what manner of person ought ye to be? And he gives the answer in verse 12. Well, the first thing is we need to be the sort of person who is looking for and hasting for the coming day of the Lord. And in verse 13, he repeats it again. We need to look for a new heaven and a new earth that will be established under the rule of the Lord Jesus Christ. And he concludes in verse 14 by saying that if we are looking for these things, then we need to be diligent. Exactly what we saw in Zephaniah. Be diligent. It's specifically mentioned here because in the days of Zephaniah, that was one of the problems. They weren't seeking Yahweh diligently. We need to be diligent. And if we look to the day, if we're diligent, then the Apostle Paul tells us here that we will be found. He will find someone who is in peace in verse 14. Without spot and blameless, this person will be marked, their name in the book of life. So may it be that each and every one of us will look to that day, that we'll seek Yahweh diligently, so that we might be amongst those that are marked by the man with the inkhorn and hidden in that great day of Yahweh.